Accession number 9342, Reel 1.
Mr. Green, tape one. Could I ask you something, Mr. Green, about your background before you joined up?
You can, yes.
Whereabouts were you born and brought up?
I was born in Russell Garden, Stanget Street in Lambeth. And I was brought up in... I went to a church school, Holy Trinity Church School. And we were a happy family. There was four brothers and two sisters. And as I wrote once, I had the best mother in the world.
What did your father do?
My father was a prentice labourer in Aldersgate Street in the city. But he was printing on the German, printing German newspapers. And I did go to see him down in this Aldersgate Street. And it was very dark and dismal as far as I was concerned. And Dad used to have to pick the print out, buy a little pair of clippers, put it in and make the words like that. And he was a very good man, very good man. He liked us kids and took us out every Sunday morning, either to Richmond on the boats or Kew. If it wasn't that, he'd take us out at a certain time to feed the ducks.
Had your father any experience of war? Had he served at all?
No, no, Dad never had an experience of war. As a matter of fact, the only experience he gave to me was the fact that Lord Roberts was a relief of Mafeking in the Boer War, and my father said, oh, he's going to be a proper Bob. And from that day to this, everyone's known me as Bob. But when I was a Boy Scout, Maurice Gammon, who was our scoutmaster, he wanted to start a troop of Boy Scouts. And the Boy Scouts Association said, there's a lot of rough boys in Lambeth if you take them on. And Maurice Gammon took them on. And Maurice Gammon, he had... he taught us, had a doctor to teach us first aid. He employed Sid Smith, who was a Burman. He was the first world flyweight champion. And Sid Smith taught me to box, which through my life has been the most wonderful thing ever. I've been able to take my part against big men, little men, anyone. And And then he had a man that taught us wrestling. He used to hire Lambeth baths every Tuesday for us to do our running. We used to run over to the Horse Guards Parade. We did our sprinting over the Horse Guards Parade. Him was in the South London areas. His brother was in the South London areas. His sister taught us to do Morris dancing. We had a Mrs. Jackson, who was a great friend of mine, because she wanted to adopt me. And Mrs. Jackson used to teach us sewing, patting and cooking. So we went to Derbyshire, we went to Birmingham, we represented the Boy Scout movement on many occasions. And when we had a son, and I named him after Maurice Gammon. Maurice. He got killed. Maurice got killed on the 1st of July 1916. My brother got killed.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My brother had a boy, he got killed five. My other brother, he had a boy and he died at five. Three sons we had, and they had no more but sons. I got a son and he lived at Shoreham. But it's been.
Did you find your experience in the Scouts, yes. Was that useful when you went to North Russia? The experience you had, you know, these skills you had gained, did it help
yes,
you?
Yes, yes. I'll tell you what, where it taught us, like Morris, a Scoutmaster, took us to a farm every year for camping. Now, I learned a lot from the farming, camping, because if you go men in the tent and the flap is you'll buy the flap of the tent and the man wants to go to the toilet, he's going to come over you and he will leave the flap of the door open. You catch the lot if it's windy or rainy. So that was one of the things it taught me. And I've said that to my children when they've gone to camp, Girl Gardener. I said, don't get near the flap of the tent. Get away from it.
How old were you when the war broke out in 1914?
I was 14.
So you were too young to be involved, is that right?
Yes, I tried all the recruiting places in London when I was 15 and a half. Because they had a shop, so they used to have a shop, make it into a recruiting. And I would go there, and if I may say so to you, that I could never get in because I had no pubic hair. And as soon as they say it, they wouldn't tell me to come back next week, you know. But what I did, how I got into the Navy, was the fact that when it was in Savoy Hill, there was a naval recruiting station, and when I went to go in to join, the sailor on the ship said, "Oh no, you're too young." So I said to him, "Yeah, wait a minute, I've got something here." So I pulled out half a crown, and I gave him the half a crown, and he said, "All right, son, you go upstairs on the first floor," and that's how I got in. Now, I wasn't very clever as a boy. I wanted to learn, I wanted to get on, but conditions weren't there. And when I got there, they gave us an exam paper because it was for signalman. And so I wasn't up to much, and the chap next to me, whose name was Herb Endersby, I said, "Excuse me, can I copy off your words?" "No, I'm not very clever at this sort of thing." He said, "Yeah, certainly." So I copied what he put like that, and so that's how I got in. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to get in even as a signalman.
So what date would that have been, Mr. Green?
Pardon me, dear? It was about 1917, December 1917, and that's when I joined. It was a Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve. So that was in December. I was called up in December, about a week after you did this testing, and we called up and we had to go to the arches in Waterloo Road, and the arch was a long arch, and there was about, it must have been 60 to 80 men, and we all had to strip off, and it was the funniest sight ever, really, to see all shapes and sizes and everything. But what I say is that they came. The officer came along, medical officer, and he put it on there, and he said, "Say ah," and that's all there was examination was, and you was in. There were no seeing if you got flat feet or any other defects, and no eyesight tests and nothing like that. That was in 1917, December 1917. And then it was about in January, I think, I was called up and had to go to Crystal Palace. And at Crystal Palace, I had an experience where I come back to my Boy Scout days, where they were still in civilian clothes. And when they gave us a hammock, and when I got the hammock, I took it down to the Africa House in Crystal Palace. And the chap said to me, "You can't hang the hammock there." So I said, "Why not?" He said, "No, you're checking out of it. It's only on the weekend leave." So I said, "Well, I'm going to hang it there and just leave it as it is." Well, then at night time, physical training instructor. I had a boxing ring. By the way, I won the South London Championship for the Boy Scout movement. And I had to go to Bermondsey, put upon. But so when they said, anyone want to fight? So I said, Benders, me, the same chap, was there. Do you fight her? So he said, no. He said, so I said, well, I'll go up. So I went up and I didn't know anything what was going to happen. And what he did, he held my hand up and he said, anybody want to fight this boy? Now, I was about 7 stone. And a big chap came up and he said, will you take him? I said, yes, I'll take him. Well, I'm not afraid. So I took this big chap one. And not boasting, don't think I'm boasting, I put him away in 2 rounds, you see. Well, then when I got down to get for my night's kip, this boy said to me, is that in the ring tonight? I said, yes. Oh, he said, you can keep your hammock there, my mate won't mind.
What sort of training did you have for the Navy in 1917?
Oh, the training... when we went to Crystal Palace, we had to do what they call a square bashing. Then we were trained with rifle drill, as the Navy called it, musketry. And then we went to school in the afternoon to learn the signalling. But the first part was physical training. And the first thing that we knew was that they used to say, and the first thing, before breakfast, you had your training at 7 o'clock, and they used to say, off gear sharply. And the physical training instructor had a cane. Off gear sharply. And the last one that got his jacket off, his jumper off, and his car fell, he was making Ben down and giving a clout on the backside.
How about the signalling training? What were the main methods of signalling in the Navy then? That you were learning?
Ah, yes, well, there were. We had the signalling instructors there. We learnt the Morse code. We learnt semaphore. And we used to have to... a black screen and a little white light kept popping. And the instructor used to tap on his key and the light cover like that. And you had to... Instead, you had a partner and he had your pencil and paper board and you had to tell him the letters that was coming out, and then that was the training for that. And then we had to do the Morse hand signalling as well. But fortunately, being in the Scouts, I must come back to the Scouts, being in the Scouts, I learnt the semaphore and I learnt the Morse code. So therefore, it was much easier for me than a lot of the men that's just going to start on it. But and then when we left there for Devonport Barracks, I got drafted to Devonport Barracks, then we still had to go and do our signalling course there in the large room, and it was very similar to what we'd had at Crystal Palace, until they pass you out as qualified, and then you've got a pair of cross flags.
How long do you think that took? You know, how long was the course before you qualified?
I should say that the course combined with Crystal Palace and Devonport Barracks, I should say that it combined 3 months at least. 3 months of training, intensive training. Because they used to call a signalman the eyes of the fleet, and the signalman used to go on the bridge with the captain. And he would read the message and the award, or to Hans Poet. He used to have in the semaphore, had a contraption where you pulled a lever. So if you wanted to go to C up there, A, B, C, D, E, F, you pulled this lever around to that and stopped. If you wanted H, which was that, you pulled the two levers down to that way. It was very interesting indeed. But I was. And to my background, my spelling wasn't 100%. As a matter of fact, when I come to there, the word was completely different to what I thought it was. So I was under that handicap. but I used to have a little dictionary, and I use a big one now, a little dictionary like that, and we had the words. I thought stationary was moving, things like that. And then I used to get this little dictionary, because as a boy I wanted to get on, but I couldn't see myself getting on. I got on in the end.
Yes, I can see that, Mr. Green.
I got on at the end. Yeah. I've been doing the post office. I did 42 years in the post office.
Yeah. Having trained, I believe you mentioned earlier to me that not much happened to you in the war. Is that right, in the Navy? You went to Malta, but didn't do much.
No, that was it. It's like this. In the barracks, there are all types of men were waiting for ships and jobs to be done, so that you didn't go to them footbags and say, right, you. There was nothing like that. You had to wait for a draft. And like we was going to go on this hydrophone flotilla draft, but we had to go to Malta, because Malta got a big dockyard, and the flotilla would come to the dockyard. Don't ask me how they was going to bring them, because we didn't know the size of the boats. But somehow or the other, we was put on, like, once or twice they'd say, you had to take a boat. Not take a boat, because you was only on that much. Malta to Marseille, and then Malta to Marseille back again. Or else some chaps was put on working the lift in the Beagie Hospital. All different things, and it was very interesting. I liked that, but wasn't enough action for me, really. Wasn't enough. I want to get there.
And, well, perhaps we ought to go on to North Russia, because I know there was a bit more attached to that for you.
Yes.
Could you tell me now about joining the North Russian Relief Force? How did this come about, Mr. Green?
Well, this was in February 1919. And that was after demob, so it took you till the time it took to demob in those days, by the fact that the war ceasing in November, we never got demobbed until February. And when he was on 28 days leave, a friend of mine, well, a schoolboy friend of mine, he's been in the Navy as well, and we were walking up Bight Hall, and we saw this board written in chalk outside the main London recruiting centre at Great Scotland Yard. And, Great Scotland Yard. And on the board it said, volunteers required from ex-service men to visit North Russia to relieve the Royal Scots who are imprisoned in there. You see? So my friend looked at me and I looked at him. I said, yes, Bill. He said, yes, Bob. So we went straight in. We hadn't finished our naval service yet. We went in, and then you had to sit down in the seat and fill out a form. And then the chap said, but you wouldn't know how to use a rifle. I said, yes, we did. We had musketry course in the Navy. Oh, yes. Oh, that's all right. We'll put it down like that. So, and then we got in. But about a fortnight afterwards, we got called up again.
When you say you got in, this sort of implies that there were lots of people wanting to join this force. Was that the case?
Yes, because I'll tell you why they wanted to join this force. A lot of men came home from the war, and they had domestic troubles with their wives, children, and they wanted to get away from all that trouble that they'd come home to. Just like a big friend of mine that I made in the army, he was engaged to be married, and when he come home, he found the girl had got married. So in his despair, he came and joined this. And another thing that happened, I don't know whether this would be authentic, but if you listen to me, there was a colonial force joined up, and these men were mainly deserters or absent without leave, whichever way you like to call it, and they were promised a free journey home if they partook of joining this force. It's like that, because we know that we knew that what they were like. They were wonderful fighters, these men, because they were rough and ready, rough as anything that you ever saw. And but they was good fighters. When we went into action, they was brave. They was nonchalant. They did nothing seemed to disturb them. And as a matter of fact, if I may say, that I had a very good experience with the chap that I said I looked to become a friend with. He came in down at Thorncliffe Barracks one night because he'd got this trouble, and he was drunk, and his bed was made next to me, and the bed consisted of just a bumping ball, planks, a couple of planks and two little trestles. And try to get a drunken man on the trestle, he knocks him over. And the chap called out, he said, "If you don't pack up, I'll put my boot in your face." So I called out to him, "You put his boot in your face, and I'll put my boot in your face. The man's drunk." Like that. And we were great friends after that. So.
And was he Australian?
No. He came from. His name was Hanley, Bobby Hanley. He's a Scots boy. He come from Buckinghamshire, Newport Pagnell in Buckinghamshire. Because I went there with him.
Ah, yes. The colonials, though, that you were telling me about, the deserters.
Oh, yes.
What nationality would they have been?
There were, I should say, there was about 80% Australians. There was a few South Africans. There was a New Zealander. No foreigners, but 90%, I should say, or 80% was Australians. Canadians a lot here, it's the second most, and there was a few Australians, a couple of New Zealanders, and there was a few South. When the river between where we were swimming, the river was so fast.
You're talking about two South Africans, I
believe. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, these two twins from the Both, their names were Botha. And owing to the fact that the swimming was so fierce, that one of the Bothas missed the rope and he wasn't seen anymore. But that name was Botha, whether they was any relation to the Botha family, which was the head of the South Africans, I don't know, but that was what it was. It was two boys Botha and one got drowned. And we had, well, it was, the river was, not only he was drowned, but the fact that I had swimming instruction from Maurice Scammon as a Boy Scout, I was a good swimmer. When I was on duty with the Corporal Cleland, and this Corporal Cleland, we had to blow the whistle to fetch them all up, because they dived off the ladder and we had the wire across, and they'd grab hold of the wire, because otherwise they weren't going to. And this young chap, I could see him doing this Catherine wheel. And I said to the Corporal Cleaner, I said, "Look," I said, "there's something wrong there." I said, he can't do that sort of thing. Mm. He was the last one out. And all of a sudden, it disappeared. But it came up again 3 days' time. And this chap that I rescued in the hut on the first night, he was a real soldier, a real man. And when they had to send the effects back to their parents, and their hand was swollen, and they wanted the ring off of that man's finger, this Bobby Hanley, he went in the tent where he was, and we came out, he said, "Oh, I got it off, Bob." I said, "How was that then?" So I said, well, I just had to put it in my mouth and wet my fingers and pulled it off.
Well, going back, that's very interesting. But if I can go back now to the period when you joined the force.
Yes.
What percentage of the relief force would you say consisted of the colonials?
Yes.
Would they have formed a very large part of the relief force, the colonial soldiers?
Yes. With regard to the colonials?
Yeah.
The number would be about 100, I should say. About 100.
Out of how many?
In their brigade, in our brigade, on the troop ship, I put there as section first, machine gunners, the fusiliers, Royal Fusiliers. There was a section of guardsmen. There was the colonial section. There was the Royal Engineers. There was the Army Service Corps. And a small naval contingent, which brought us over. And that was the brigade. That was what we was termed as Jackson's Brigade.
Why were you called Jackson's Brigade? Was Jackson
Brigadier General Jackson. He was the man responsible for anything that happened to the brigade when we went to North Russia. But then we never saw a great lot of Brigadier Jackson because, well, he was behind the scenes. We had our colonel in charge of us was a Colonel Clark. And Colonel Clark was a strict disciplinarian. And when we was at Folkestone, it was a payday, about the second payday it was, as we went to get our money, the colonel said, get your hair cut first. And everyone practically had to go out to the camp barber outside the pay office and have his hair shone off. And he only knew back and sides, all the lot came off. But fortunately, the colonel himself, he had his hair cut off right as close as ours. So there, but the Australians, they was good soldiers, but the discipline, I might say, wasn't really there. When we had to sweep up the barracks and things like that, the Australians said, no, we've come to fight, we're not going to sweep up like that. But of course, when they went into action, yes, they were good.